there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 281. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have such a fun show for you this week. We must get started with our first guest. Casper Andreas is an award-winning actor, writer, director, and film producer. As an actor, he can be seen in the independent film I Dream Too Much and the Hulu original series Deadbeat. He has also been seen on The Late Show, Hitch, Little Children, and Celebrity. As a filmmaker, Casper has garnered acclaim all around the world for his work, including A Four-Letter Word in 2007, Between Love and Goodbye in 2008, The Big Gay Musical in 2009, and Going Down in La La Land in 2011, and a ton more. In early 2013, Casper directed his first Swedish film, a short drama entitled Ett sista farväl, based on his own script. The film was accepted into over 80 film festivals. It won an audience award at the Torino International Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, and it won Best LGBT Short Film right here at the Cleveland International Film Festival. In addition to all of that, he was previously selected to the Out 100 Most Influential and Newsworthy GLBT People by Out Magazine. His newest project is called Kiss Me, Kill Me. It has just the most incredible cast, including my huge crush, and we'll talk about that. It's a film that you, yes, you can help fund. Casper, welcome back to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you so much. That was quite the introduction.
Tack så mycket for being here. I did my research.
Oh, of course. Yes, that was great.
You know, I say welcome back, Casper, because you were first on our show over 5 years ago. That was a long time ago, my friend.
It's been a while, yes. What film were we talking about then? Do you remember?
We were talking about The Big Gay Musical was just about to come out.
Of course, yes. That's probably one of my most popular films.
Yeah, we love it.
The Big Gay Musical.
We love it.
Well,
we have so much to discuss. Are you ready, sir?
I'm ready.
Well, let's start where we start with all of our filmmakers. Take us back, Casper. Why the medium of film to get your voice out there? What is it about the medium of film that just calls your name?
You know, I never really set out to be a filmmaker when I started in the entertainment industry. I started as an actor, and then I was, you know, really enjoyed working on films, and I decided to write my first screenplay. And as I was writing it, I thought, like, oh, I really want to direct this.
Yeah.
And then I set out to direct a film, and I realized the best way to get it done is to produce it yourself. So I got into learning about independent filmmaking, and I made my first feature. But I think being a filmmaker and being a film director, it's the most creative job imaginable. You know, because as an actor, you speak other people's words and you do what people tell you to do, and it's very creative and fun. But most of the time, as an actor, you're looking for a job.
Right.
So being a filmmaker, being a director, I'll get to, you know, work on projects. Making one film takes a long time. So it's a long process of figuring out what I want to do and how to get the script where I want it, either if I write it or if someone else has written it. And it's just very creative in every aspect of the way I get to tell everyone what to do. I make all the decisions about clothing, about hair, about locations, lighting. It's really, really a cool job.
Nice.
Highly recommend it.
Now, how would you describe your voice as a director? If I went and talked to all of your actors, what would they say about you as a director? What's your style?
I think most of them, would, if not all of them, would say that I'm a very actor's director. Since I started as an actor, when I made my first film, Slutty Summer, which is about it's a romantic comedy, just so you know. But when I made that first film, I was only interested in the performances. I was working really hard to get the performances out of the actors, and I didn't really care about where we set the camera up or you know, the lighting and stuff. I didn't really care that much about that for my first film because, you know, I was new,
right,
to filmmaking, and but I knew acting and I knew what I wanted to, you know, with the actors to portray. So as I learned, and for each film, I'm trying to get better with each film and grow as a filmmaker. But one thing that I'm always really, my favorite part of making films is to work with the actors and figure out how to get them to perform the way I want them to perform. And you know, actors, good actors are just so wonderful to work with when they bring so much to the table. You know, they bring so much to their roles that, you know, me, I can't even, you know, imagine myself in advance. So it's just, it's really wonderful to work with actors, and I really love working with actors. So I think they would all say that I'm very willing to listen to them and very willing to try whatever they want to try. But I also have, I think I'm pretty good at giving directions and get them to get into the direction they need to be for the role.
Nice. Now, speaking of good actors, in a few of your films, you have directed and also acted. What the heck kind of conflict of interest is that, Casper?
It's a big conflict of interest. As an actor, I love, of course, to be in my own movies and in other people's movies. You know, acting is a lot of fun. But as a director, I hate when I cast myself because, you know, as a director, you just really want to look at the big picture and you want to sit behind the monitor and see where everything that's happening on screen as we're filming. And if I'm in the film, you know, I can't do that at the same time. So it's definitely frustrating for me as a director if I have cast my, but then once it's over, once we're in editing and, you know, once the film comes out, you know, I love being part of the cast also because, you know, I started as an actor, so acting is always, I don't know, my first love or a big, you know, definitely a big part of who I am and what I enjoy. But I've been selective. I acted in my first film. I didn't act in my next three films, really. I had a little cameo in Big and Musical, but very tiny. And then I decided to put myself back on screen in Violet Tennessee, and then going down in La La Land. I had a really nice role in that one. And now I'm in my new film. I'm not playing any of the leads. I have a little tiny cameo in it, just for fun.
In my head, you were directing Going Down in La La Land, and at one point you just yelled out, "The only actor doing it right is that guy over there," and you pointed and you ran over to that spot and said, "Oh, me?" That's what I think happened.
You know, what happened was, from my first film, which we had no money. I mean, we made that film for, like, you know, basically a shooting budget was $15,000. We did not have time to stop and for me to look at what we had shot. So I just kind of had to, if I was in the film, I didn't know what we had shot. You know, I could just like, oh, did that look good, everybody? Okay, great, let's move on to the next scene type of thing. So that's why I took a long break until four films later. I was like, well, you know, we do have enough money now that I could actually watch a few of my takes, make sure that everything is the way I want it to be and such. And so I had a, you know, a supporting role in one film, and then I gave myself a bigger part in my latest feature that, you know, Going Down in La La Land, where I might have given myself an extra take or two at times just to make sure I gave some variations of my performance to make sure, you know, we had something good to work with.
I love it. I love that there is the potential for an actor to complain to the director that you are giving yourself too much screen time. I love that idea.
You know, I think I'm pretty good though as a director. I mean, cut me out if, you know, I'm not like making sure I have all that screen time. But when in terms of the, you know, if I was shooting in Going Down in La La Land, I worked with this wonderful actor, Matthew Ludwinski, who stars in the film. And pretty much all my scenes were with him one-on-one, cause of the storyline which made it, when we did his close-up, of course I could watch what he was doing and I could see what was going on. But then from my close-up, it took a little longer because I had to, you know, play back and then adjust myself after the fact.
There you go. Well, let's take a step back, sir. We have to talk about gay films, because if you go to a lot of the different sites and you click on, you know, if you go to your Netflix or various different sites and you're trying to find LGBT content in films, it's not the longest list in the world. And quite frankly, I think about 28-29% of them are your films. How are you feeling these days about the state of LGBT representation in films?
Well, you know, LGBT representation in mainstream Hollywood, I think, has actually almost gone down. You know, like, Hollywood is making less and less films, and it's all very much planned now to reach the biggest audience possible. And, And it's, you know, if you think about it, like all the Hollywood films that comes out now, very few gay characters in
right.
them. And you know, that's very different from TV. TV, there's a lot of gay characters now, which we of course love. But in terms of in the big screen, there's very few gay roles in the Hollywood films. And in terms of the independent films, you know, there's actually more films made than ever, I think, in the history of filmmaking, because it's so much cheaper now with digital technology to make a film. A lot of people set out to do it, and there is there's a lot of films being made, and I think there's a lot of gay films being made also. I don't think everything gets released or you know ends up on Netflix and iTunes and such because you know not everything is good enough.
Right.
Or seemed like to be interesting enough for a bigger audience. But I don't think my percentage in the genre is 28%. I mean, I made six films, but and I do think there's a lot of great films out there. One problem though that I'm facing as a filmmaker, and I know all other American filmmakers also are facing, is that there's just no money for budgets anymore.
Yeah.
Because there's just it's very hard to, you know, DVD sales are way down, and that's where the money used to be coming from, you know, the income from the distribution. So now everyone watches things on Netflix, and Netflix pays filmmakers almost nothing.
Right.
So therefore, it's getting really hard for American filmmakers to put a lot of money into a film, and obviously if you don't have a lot of money, it's hard to make a really good quality film.
Right. Well, can we go through some of your films? We're going to get to Kiss Me, Kill Me, which so much excitement there, and we want everybody to help fund it, so we're going to get to that. But talk to us about some of the lessons that you learned. I'll give you some of your films, and tell me what you learned about yourself as the filmmaker. What were the big lessons that you walked away with? What about The Big Gay Musical, which, again, that's where we left off 5 years ago. What did you learn about yourself, Casper, by doing The Big Gay Musical?
What did I learn about myself by doing The Big Gay Musical? You know, Big Gay Musical was a very interesting project because I came on as I was only supposed to co-direct it with Fred Caruso, who had written the screenplay, and I wasn't supposed to produce it at all. But then I ended up coming on as a producer after the fact because he needed help with the fundraising and getting it all done. I guess I learned that that's a tough question. I don't know if I want to answer it. I almost said I learned I don't want to co-direct again.
That's an important lesson.
But that's not necessarily true. I would consider co-directing again. I just it's interesting. You know, as a filmmaker, you're very as a director, it's hard to have two directors on, I find.
Oh yeah.
Because you have very different, you know, goals, or like you see things differently. Me and Fred actually solved it very well making that film because he directed all the, you know, big musical numbers and stuff. He had the musical theater background and I had none of that, and I directed the more of the real aspects of the film, you know, the behind the scenes stuff. That was basically, the film tells two stories, but what I did learn was that I would love to direct a musical. It was so much fun, and I so admire those our singer, actor, dancers, who were just so fantastic. So I would love to make another musical, so that's something I learned. Wow, I got it.
Don't knock the co-directing. I mean, even as a professor, co-teaching is really hard. It's not a knock on your co-teacher. It's just you have a vision, they have a vision, and sometimes it's not the easiest for your audience to pick up on that. So I support you in that. But yes, more musicals. I'll make you do two more. What did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker for the big one, Going Down in La La Land?
You know, Going Down in La La Land was the first film where I did not want to compromise.
Nice.
I felt like... I kind of knew when I made it that I was going to take a break from filmmaking, which I ended up doing because I had been making a year and for a few years there. So I kind of knew that I was ready for a break, and I really wanted it to be my best film ever. I mean, that's always been a goal for each film. Like, I wanted to be better than the last. But with La La Land, I really wanted to make the best film ever, and I didn't want to compromise on stuff like, you know, like, oh, we don't have enough extras. Let's just shoot it anyway and just do really tight close-up shots and no one will notice, that kind of thing, you know, which I always had to do before. And so we went over budget a little bit, but I feel like I really got everything I wanted in that film, and I'm very, very proud of the finished product. So what did I learn? I learned to fight harder as a director, fight harder with my, you know, I produced my own stuff. So the director in me fought harder with the producer me to get everything I wanted as a director so that, you know, to make the finished product the best possible.
Awesome. Awesome. Last one. Now, am I even close to pronouncing it correctly when I say Et Sista Farval?
Yes, except the last word, farvel.
Oh, I see.
The farvel is the word.
That's why I would just say a last farewell. It's a short drama, which I saw here at the Cleveland Film Festival, so that was very exciting. And short films, I would imagine, we've spoken with directors of short films on some previous episodes. That has its own set of challenges, does it not?
It does. I mean, as a short film, you have to really figure out how to tell the story in that format, and for the film to have a beginning, middle, and an end, and like take people on a journey without, you know, I think a lot of short films that start out really fantastic and then they just kind of end, and you feel like left wondering, well, what's happening? You know, I want to see more. Which is, of course, it's great if you, as a filmmaker, plan to turn it into a feature and you want people wanting more. But I think the challenge to make a short film is to tell a whole story. I mean, that's kind of like the point of making a short film, that it's a story that it's not supposed to be told in the long form. It's just, you know, a story that's supposed to be short.
Yeah.
So that was something that I really wanted to do with I Last Farewell and make it... and make it like something. It's a 12-minute film, and I do think people, it does take people on a journey, and it was a lot of fun.
Oh, it's so great.
What did I learn from it?
Yes.
Is that what you were going to ask me? Well, I learned, it was my first, I'm from Sweden originally, but it was the first time I went back to Sweden and made a film. One thing I learned is that it was very similar, everything about how to make a film was very simple. All the crew positions were all the same. People were very much the same style of making films in Sweden, and I'm sure most of Europe, as it is here in the U.S. I also learned that I learned how to direct in Swedish. It was interesting because a lot of times I having lived in the U.S. for so long, I kind of started. It was hard for me sometimes to express what I wanted in Swedish, but I had such fantastic actors, so I didn't need to express myself too much. It was a really wonderful experience.
I love it. All right, well, that brings us to our current project, Kiss Me, Kill Me. This is what I've learned about you. I learned that you, sir, like me, a big Agatha Christie fan.
Yes.
What draws you to the murder mysteries?
You know, I don't know. I just, I think when I was like in middle school, we had to read a book every month or something, and somehow I ended up reading an Agatha Christie novel. And then I just loved it so much. And I was like 10, 11, and I just started reading all of them. I literally read them by the age of 12, all her books. I think the suspense of it and trying to figure out, when I was reading those books, I remember always trying to figure out who the killer was. And I I love that kind of aspect of a murder mystery when you're trying to figure out what's going on and like, oh, paying attention to stuff like what's going on. Why did that just happen? That must mean something, and stuff like that. So I always love that with those type of books and those type of movies. So it's going to be so much fun working on Kiss Me, Kill Me, and hopefully bring some of the aspects of Agatha Christie novels, so like, you know, the Hitchcock suspense type of movies into this film.
Nice. Now, I have to ask you, how do you even go about assembling such a cast? Because we're talking, I mean, Gail Harold from Queer as Folk and three-time Emmy nominee Van Hanses and just a ton of folks, including Willem and my obsession, who we'll get to in a second, who I haven't said yet, but we'll get to him. How do you go about assembling such a cast?
You know, it's been actually a long journey because we knew we wanted to fund the film by crowdsourcing, and so we felt like, you know, for people to pay any attention to our Kickstarter campaign versus every other out there, we needed to have as much things in place as possible, and having a fantastic cast that people are interested in seeing, I think, has helped bring a lot of attention to our project. So we approached people at different times. We actually attached Gail Harold very early on. He read the script and he really responded to it and was very excited about the role that we had him in mind for. So he signed on. And how we got to him was because my producing partner David Micah Barrett, who also wrote the screenplay, he made a film last year called Such Good People, and he actually had cast Randy Harrison from Queer as Folk in that film. So somehow, I think through Randy, he got in touch with Gail, and that's how that happened. Then Hans is he was, you know, the first regular gay character on a daytime soap. He was on the Festival Turn for years, and as you mentioned, he was nominated for Emmys like 3 times.
Oh yeah,
and he's a really fantastic actor. But he's been doing a web series called Eastsiders, created by Kit Williamson, who's also in our cast. And so Kit is a friend with my producer, and we both really like Van's work on Eastsiders. And so we met with him, and he was all excited about being in the film also. So that's how we got those two guys. And we have Brianna Brown, who is wonderful. She was on Homeland and Devious Maids. And she was also a friend of Kit Williamson. So that's how we got to her. So basically, I've been a lot of personal connections. This is a very small film. It's a very limited budget. So we tried as much as possible to avoid going through people's agents and stuff, because usually the big Hollywood agents, they don't really care about it, small films like this, because their cut of the income is going to be so small. So we really tried to work up personal connections to get the cast together.
Well, you have not yet mentioned my husband, who doesn't know that he's my husband, and I understand that he's in a relationship, but I don't really care. My obsession with Tom Lenk is huge. I just want to put that out there.
Oh, that's very exciting to hear. I didn't know who you were going to say. Tom Lenk is amazing. Yes. He was on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and he was actually in Argo, and he's a friend, David also, my co-producer, my producing partner. So that's how we got him attached to the film.
Yeah.
I thought maybe for a moment there you were going to say Matthew Ludwinski from my film Going Down in La La Land.
Well, again, very attractive gentleman, very talented, but Tom Lenk, oh, my heart, yes. So we'll work on that. That can be a whole separate crowdsourcing campaign to get us together. You and I will work on that off the air.
Yeah. What about Willem?
Love Willem. I will say that in the 280 previous episodes of This Show Is So Gay, I don't think I've ever had to bleep out as much as when I had Willem on this show.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
I love Willem. I just love that how much she can speak her mind, and she was just so quick-witted. I loved it. I loved it. But yes, some cussing, which I thought was hilarious.
Yeah. Yes. And he's also a great actor, so I'm very much looking forward to having him in the film. It's going to be a lot, so much fun working with all these people.
You've mentioned it, and I want to go deeper into it. Crowdsource funding, relatively new in the scheme of funding projects, you know, in the past 7-8 years. Talk to me about how incredible it is to have these folks contribute to your projects through crowdsource funding. At the time of this recording, we're already at $52,804. You're a little more than halfway there, and we're totally going to get you there. And everyone's going to stroll in over to Kickstarter.com, and you're going to type in Kiss Me, Kill Me. We'll link to it as well, and you can help fund this. Talk to me about the joys of crowdsource funding.
You know, it is fantastic to feel the support that we're getting from a lot of fans and supporters that are willing to part with their hard-earned cash to help us make this film and be part of making this film. So it is a fantastic. It's also very stressful, because we don't, you know, at this point we have 14 days left. We had a 30-day campaign, so we're a little bit less. We have 2 weeks left, and we still have to raise $47,000.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of money to raise in 2 weeks. So we are definitely, working hard and trying to get the word out and so that people check it out. You know, it doesn't take, you know, of course it's great if someone comes and gives us $10,000, but basically with crowdfunding, the point of it is to have a lot of people give a little, and by having the support of a lot of people, we can get there, I think. So far right now we have 424 backers. And, one can back it just with a few dollars or we can, you know, for $25, you actually get the film this is the one cool thing we're going to do. I don't know if a lot of people are doing this. We don't know where the film's going to premiere yet. It's going to premiere at a film festival, but we don't know when and where that's going to be. But we're going to simultaneously let everyone who backed our campaign watch the film online as that screening is happening, so that they can be part of the premiere. Wherever they are in the world.
That's fantastic.
And then, of course, they're going to get a digital download of it later.
Nice.
And we have DVDs. We have actually speaking roles that you can get in the film and all that stuff. So it's all on our Kickstarter page. You can actually, you don't have to go to Kiss. You can, we have our own website. It's kissmekillmemovie.com. So kissmekillmemovie.com. And if you go there, it just takes you directly to our Kickstarter page.
Perfect. Perfect. There's so many great incentives. Of course, one of the incentives that you get to be a part of this process. I wasn't sure, though, I'm looking at the page right now. At what funding level does my contribution earn me the Tom Lenk proposal? I wasn't sure where at what funding level that was.
You know, that's a pledge level we haven't added yet.
Okay.
You know. So I will have to get back to you on that one.
Please do. Please do, because I am in for that pledge as long as it's less than $50.
Oh,
but yes.
Good.
Yes.
I'll let him know.
So what's next? So we are going to push this like crazy, right? We are going to – I have no doubt we're going to get to the $100,000. I don't – you know, like that's no question in my mind.
That's so sweet of you to say. I am definitely in doubt. I mean, I never done this before. I never attempted this before. But I do feel like this is the only way to – for me as a filmmaker, like, I either had to make my budget really tiny or I have to figure out another way of funding a film because of the nature of the state of the film business now, it's really hard to make enough money back on a film from the distribution when the general population are willing to pay very little to watch a film. And if it's not on Netflix, they just watch something else. So that is the bitter film producer me talking, but as a consumer, of course, it's great to have all the yeah. access to all these amazing films and TV shows. So this is the first time I'm attempting to do this, to raise $100,000, on Kickstarter to fund the film. I don't know. I mean, other people have done it. A lot of people have failed doing it. So I really hope that we can get enough people excited about it, and get us all the way there.
Yeah. Talk to me about what motivates you through, because we've had so many independent filmmakers on the show, and if I ever had any inclination to be an independent filmmaker, which is not where my talents are, I think that I would probably be nervous to do it because you all have done so well, as you just did, to articulate the challenges of trying to get your content out there in our, you know, revenue-dominated market. What motivates you through those tough times, because you're actually not a bitter film producer. I think that you are just so you're so inspiring. What motivates you to keep going to get this content out there?
Well, you know, I do think that I'm passionate about telling gay-themed stories, and I think those stories should be told. And I have an amazing time doing it. I love pretty much every aspect of the filmmaking process. You know, as I said, I love working with the actors. I do love the post-production aspect when you sit there in the editing room and figure out how to cut it together and make it, you know, just right, and picking the music and all that. And then of course, the best part is going to film festivals and showing the film to audiences and get the response. You know, I've been very lucky that usually my films have been very well received, and I feel very, you know, I'm very humbled by that and very happy about that. But that's amazing to go to screenings and show my work and get all that, you know, get a lots of love from the audience. So I guess that's what keeps me going. You know, people responding to my work and I get emails from people who tells me how much, you know, one of my films might have meant to them and stuff like that. And it's really exciting. It's nice to feel like, you know, you're doing something that means something to others.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, last question for you, because I even read in your bio that you're available for film consultation. So let's get some free advice for all of our independent filmmakers out there. And in particular, our filmmakers who are listening to the show who want to get their LGBT characters and LGBT content out there. What is that piece of advice that would really help them to keep them going?
Well, a couple of things. I think, first of all, just do it. You know, the Nike slogan, to just don't. I mean, I think a lot of people are afraid to share their art with the world. Making a film and putting it out there, you know, you're inviting people to criticize you, especially these days when anyone can say nasty things about you online, it's easy to get scared off by that. But I know writers who have written scripts and who, when I was like, oh, I'll read it, you know, I can give you feedback. It's like, no, I don't want to show it to anyone. You know, if you don't want to, if you're not willing to share it, you know, you're never going to become a filmmaker. You have to put yourself out there.
Right.
So, you know, you just don't worry about what people think and do your best. You know, I think I'm a much better filmmaker now than I was 10 years ago when I made my first film. And, but I wouldn't be any better now if I hadn't made that first film. So I think it's, you know, it's a journey, and I think, you know, just have to take your first step and keep going.
There you go. There you go. Well, look, it's been 5 years. You've been so prolific in the past 5 years of putting content out there. My hope is that you know just how important of a voice that you have in the LGBT landscape of putting out content that we can all access, that we can see ourselves on film, and in particular, because we are all in the LGBT community accessing the mainstream media and not necessarily seeing many representations of us, it's so critically important that we have folks like you who are taking the time and the energy and the passion and channeling them into projects that are entertaining us but also allowing us to see ourselves in the media. That's so critical and so life-saving and so life-altering for our community. And my hope is you know what an important role you play.
Thank you so much. It's so sweet of you to say. Thank you.
So everyone needs to stroll on over to kissmekillmemovie.com. That will take you directly to the Kickstarter page. It's an incredible cast. It's a murder mystery. It's going to be so entertaining. All of my favorite actors are there, including my imaginary husband, who, after my pledge, will become Mr. Tom Lenkschneck, so we'll work on that. Casper, what an absolute treat having you back on the show. Can we not let another 5 years go by?
Yes, for sure.
Awesome.
I'm happy to be back. I would love to come back when the film is finished, and we can talk about it again once you've seen it.
You got it. You got it. Casper, what an absolute treat. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Merry Christmas, it's Murder Keepers!
When it's Christmas time, it's raining, and the snow is very deep. He holds up in his kitchen to make his Christmas tree.
Well, tons of time to share some gay news and just my own views with you for this week. Becca had another catering gig this week. I thought for a second, oh gosh, this is like the third hosting gig curse that's alive and well on this show is so gay. As I've said, a number of co-hosts have lasted two episodes, but only a few have made it to the third episode. But she had all these baked goods in the kitchen and she was working really hard. So unless it was this unbelievably elaborate ruse to get out of co-hosting for a third time, I promise you, Becca will be back with us next week. And we've all this new recording equipment to try out that's going to increase the quality of the show. It's going to be amazing. So next week, Becca will be back with us. But for this week, you got me, you got the gay news, and Ken's views. We start with Arizona. Arizona Attorney General Tom Horn last Friday announced that his office will not, they will not, appeal a ruling against the state's marriage equality ban, which will now lead a number of same-sex couples in the state to seek marriage licenses. Horn said in a press conference that both he and Governor Jan Brewer agreed that appealing the decision would be a waste of state resources. Tom Horn said this, quote, "I have decided not to appeal today's decision, which would be an exercise in futility." Okay, so that's what they decided there in Arizona, not to appeal. Now you would think that, okay, they're just accepting it. But no, Governor Jan Brewer, she has made a series of statements. I would like to tell you about them. She said that she was disappointed in the Ninth Circuit Court judge's striking down of the state's gay marriage ban. She said that last Friday. She described it as troubling, and then she alleged that U.S. District Judge John Sedgwick struck down the ban as part of a personal agenda. Here is her full quote. You ready? Quote, in 2008, this is Governor Jan Brewer, not Ken Schneck, Governor Jan Brewer. Quote, in 2008, Arizona voters approved a state constitutional amendment to define marriage as a union of one man and one woman. Now with their rulings, the federal courts have again thwarted the will of the people and further eroded the authority of states to regulate and uphold our laws. It is not only disappointing, but also deeply troubling that unelected federal judges can dictate the laws of individual states, create rights based on their personal policy preferences, and supplant the will of the people in an area traditionally left to the states for more than 200 years. As Justice Scalia opined, such action is tantamount to an assertion of judicial supremacy over the people and is an image of the judiciary that would have been unrecognizable to those who wrote and ratified our national charter. Simply put, courts should not be in the business of making and changing laws based on their personal agendas. It is not the role of the judiciary to determine that same-sex marriages should be allowed. Historically and traditionally, that power belongs to the states and to the people. If society wants to recognize same-sex marriages or civil unions, that decision should be made through our elected representatives or at the ballot, not the courts. End quote. Holy cow. Now, if you listen to last week's episode, you might largely hear me say the exact same commentary, because it's just so striking to me. Here you have the governor of Arizona saying that the only way decisions should be made is through elected representatives or at the ballot, not the courts. What on earth is she talking about? The courts did not decide. She said the courts should not be in the business of making and changing laws based on their personal agendas. It is not the role of the judiciary to determine that same-sex marriages should be allowed. Yeah, Jan Brewer, that's not what the courts did. The courts did not set out to determine that same-sex marriages should be allowed. The courts were presented with a case, with a lawsuit, because that's what we allow people to do. We allow them to sue for their rights. That's part of our system of democracy here. The courts were presented with a lawsuit. They then looked at the Constitution and they decided, oh, gosh, I understand that the state may have made this law and the people might have voted on it, but it's against the Constitution. How do you just say the court should have no place in our process? I don't get it. And I'm trying not to be so base as just to immediately go to, really? What about Brown versus Board of Education? But seriously, what about Brown versus Board of Education? What about any number of lawsuits that have given minorities rights that they rightfully deserve under our Constitution? That's why we have the court system. That's what checks and balances are. I don't understand the cherry picking, the picking and choosing of saying this is when we want the courts to intervene, but when it's against what the states have voted on or what the people have voted on, no, then that's not okay. First of all, as we say week in and week out, what every pundit says everywhere, we don't put minority rights up for majority votes. That's what you did, Arizona. Of course, the majority is going to vote for the majority rights because it is in their interest to keep minorities away from having those rights. So let's not say that the voting process is not without its flaws, because it is. But fine, they voted on it, shouldn't have happened, it did. Then we count on our court system to interpret the Constitution. And by the way, the courts don't just come out of nowhere. They're not just these rogue states that pop up and have jurisdiction, or as Scalia said, supremacy. I know that it's a little bit diluted in some people's views, but the courts are technically elected. They're appointed by people that we elect. They don't just come out of nowhere. And a lot of these judges were appointed by Republican presidents. It's not about a personal agenda. It's about comparing the case in front of them to the Constitution. It's just so wishy-washy. It's so flip-floppy for these politicians to be saying, yes, down with the courts, when in other circumstances, they're all for the courts intervening. You didn't hear Governor Jan Brewer stepping up and saying, oh, Supreme Court, you should not have decided that way in Citizens United. She was thrilled with the Citizens United decision because it led to more donations for her. But when it's against something that she personally is not for, then no, the courts have no place here. I just don't get it. I don't understand how we just ignore one of the three branches when one of those three branches is not siding our way. It's fine for the regular average Joe on the street, which, by the way, I don't think it's fine then, but for a governor, it's just ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense. So that's my big rant on Arizona and Governor Jan Brewer, who called the marriage ruling disappointing, and of course, it's like, well, it's got to be this guy's personal agenda. You have a personal agenda, Jan Brewer. We all do. That's okay. But this guy used the Constitution. That's what judges do. There you go. We're going to switch gears completely. I don't know how you get from Governor Jan Brewer to Jillian Michaels, the trainer from The Biggest Loser, but I got to put it out there. Jillian Michaels, this is according to the Huffington Post, she recently sat down with Health Magazine to discuss her life after The Biggest Loser, how she stays fit, and her identity as a queer woman. While she may be in a relationship with a woman, the gay thing, that's a quote, she calls it the gay thing, is still something that she struggles to talk openly about. This is what she said, quote, I don't know that I'm comfortable talking about being gay now, to be honest with you. The gay thing has always been hard for me. When Heidi and I are out and somebody older asks, are you sisters? I say, we're friends. I guess it comes from thinking that they will be shocked or disturbed. Look, I wish I had some strapping football player husband. It would be such a dream to be normal like that, but I'm just not. So again, it would be such a dream to be normal like that, but I'm just not. And Jillian Michaels has taken a lot of flack for that comment, and it is a little bit unfortunate, so we kind of expect that any minute she will be coming out and saying, hey, not exactly what I meant. Not good with the normal. Not good with the normal thing. Don't like that one at all. Hey, the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network, GLSEN, has released their annual survey, which is a big deal. Huge numbers of LGBT students reported problems at school. Of the nearly 8,000 students ages 13 to 21 who were surveyed, more than 55% reported feeling unsafe at school due to their sexual orientation. Now, here's the good news. That's down from 64% in 2011. Okay, so this is the survey from the 2012-2013 school year. It's better, but still a majority of our LGBT students are reporting feeling unsafe at school. 36% faced physical harassment, including pushing or shoving, which is a drop of 2 percentage points from the earlier survey, but still 36% say that they faced physical harassment. More than 16% said they were physically assaulted, sometimes with a weapon, which again, it's a decline of 2 percentage points, so that's better. But students have largely said that they avoid places at school that made them feel unsafe. Eliza Byard, who was on our 250th episode, she's the executive director of GLSEN. She told the Huffington Post this quote, you see tremendous progress since 2011. That being said, it still means far too many students are experiencing anti-LGBT violence and discrimination. The survey found that certain school policies contribute to discrimination. More than half of the students who were surveyed reported hearing teachers or school staff make homophobic remarks against LGBT students. We're not talking about their fellow students. We're talking about teachers and school staff. More than half of the students reported that they've heard that. Further, school staff often fail to protect LGBT students. That's what students report in the survey. The number of students who said school staff members intervened to stop bullying was unchanged from 2011, which again, that means we need more training of school staff. Eliza Byard said the new report provides greater detail than earlier surveys on how schools discriminate against LGBT students. For example, nearly 18% of students reported being prevented from, quote, discussing or writing about LGBT topics in school assignments. Nearly 16% were prohibited from wearing clothes or items supporting LGBT issues. For the first time, the survey asked students whether they had heard negative remarks about transgender people. Byard said, quote, we don't know if that's on the way up or down. The increased visibility in trans students and issues makes it a place where we have to pay attention. Byard further said that she worries that school structures and policies are not keeping pace with changes in student behavior. She concluded by saying, quote, in our current political climate, that really makes me worried. So much work to be done in our schools. Does it look like things are getting better? Absolutely, but it's marginally. And again, the majority of our LGBT youth in schools are reporting struggling. So we have to do more about that. We have to do more about that. A Catholic high school has denied a production company permission to shoot a film on its premises after learning that the movie's plot involved a lesbian relationship between characters played by Julianne Moore and Ellen Page. Salesian High School, which is a Catholic boys' school, reportedly told a location scout that the school would be available for a pivotal scene in the upcoming film Freeheld. However, the school's principal, John Flaherty, informed filmmakers that they could not shoot at the school. According to BuzzFeed, Freeheld tells the story of a lesbian couple attempting to fight discrimination and earn domestic partner benefits. Julianne Moore's character is dying of lung cancer and wants to leave her benefits to Paige, who plays her partner in the film. Producer Michael Schamberg reportedly wrote to the principal attempting to inform him that the film is not about gay marriage, nor are the women attempting to get married. It is about recognizing the dignity of a woman who was a brave civil servant. However, Schamberg did not receive a response. The principal did respond to BuzzFeed's request for a statement explaining why he did not want a queer film shooting in the school, stating, quote, "All are welcomed at Salesian High School. Our school chooses to embrace the social issues such as hunger, homelessness, poverty, and helping the less fortunate." So there you go. Ellen Page took to Twitter to offer her own thoughts on the situation. She tweeted, quote, "Using religion to justify bigotry makes me sad. Sending my support to the LGBT students at the school who I hope are able to find acceptance." Love that, Ellen Page. That's a great tweet. So, not going to shoot there at the Catholic high school. Over in Alaska, at a Wasilla High School assembly Tuesday morning this week, United States Representative Don Young did not temper his notoriously abrasive personality for his young audience. Numerous witnesses say that Young, who is 81 years old, United States Representative Don Young, this is not an Alaskan state senator, this is not small town stuff, this is United States Representative Don Young. He acted in a disrespectful and sometimes offensive manner to some students. He used profanity, and he started talking about, you ready, bull sex. That would be bull sex when confronted with a question about same-sex marriage. Principal Amy Spargo said this, quote, "We really spend a lot of time in our school talking about how we treat each other. We just don't talk to people that way." School officials said it was quite concerning when Young made, this is United States Representative Don Young, he made what they called hurtful and insensitive statements about suicide just days after a Wasilla student took his own life. The encounter occurred after teacher Carla Swick posed a question about Alaska's high suicide and domestic violence rates and asked what United States Representative Don Young's office is doing about it. Don Young started talking about suicide, mentioning the role played by alcohol and depression. The school didn't record the assembly. But then, witnesses say, Young said suicide shows a lack of support from friends and family. Which, by the way, if you listen to Billy Meyer's interview on last week's episode, you will know that's extraordinarily offensive. It's crazy. And then people started shouting at this United States representative. People were shouting, he had friends, he had support. And the principal said, the kid said, it's depression, you know, a mental illness. And as she remembers it, United States Representative Don Young replied, well, what, do you just go to the doctor and get diagnosed with suicide? They also said that he was using profanity, words that I can't say on this show, so that's not good. And then we get to the questions about same-sex marriage. United States Representative Don Young. Okay, this is what happened. A student asked Young to speak on his stance on gay marriage. Wasilla Junior Zachary Greer told the Alaska Dispatch News, quote, I asked why it is so bad in your eyes. According to the principal, Young replied, quote, you can't have marriage with two men. What do you get with two bulls? That was his reply. You can't have marriage with two men. What do you get with two bulls? So his spokesperson said that maybe he should have been, quote, more sensitive in light of the recent suicide. This was the quote that came out of the office. Congressman Young was very serious and forthright when discussing the issue of suicide, in part because of the high number of tragedies that affect Alaskan youth. He discussed what he believes are leading causes of youth suicide in our state and shared some suggestions for helping family members and friends who are dealing with suicidal thoughts. In no way did Congressman Young mean to upset anyone with his well-intentioned message. In light of the tragic events affecting affecting the Wasilla High School community, he should have taken a much more sensitive approach. When even your spokesperson is out there saying, hey, my congressman, for whom I release statements, should have been more sensitive, you know it's problematic. I would like to again repeat, his answer was, what do you get with two bulls? That would be United States Representative Don Young there in the great state of Alaska. Big, big news on the presidential front. President Barack Obama has said that he has evolved his stance yet again. Because remember, he started out when he was running for president saying, yeah, I don't know. I think that marriage should be between one man and one woman. And then he evolved his stance, and then he evolved it again. And then he talked to Robin Roberts, and he said he's all for marriage equality. He's evolved it again. He recently told The New Yorker that he believes that same-sex couples should have a right to marry under the U.S. Constitution, which is a change from his previous statements asserting that the issue should be left to states. He said, quote, ultimately, I think the Equal Protection Clause does guarantee same-sex marriage in all 50 states. So that would be huge, huge. More from the federal front, federal contractors would be barred from LGBT discrimination under a rule that has gone to the Office of Management and Budget for review and is being finalized by the Department of Labor. The rule stems from an executive order signed by President Barack Obama, that same guy who just evolved his views. So this is a big deal. He signed that back in July. Now it's going to go into effect. The final text will soon be available in the Federal Register. So that's great. So I talked at the end of last week's show about the Catholic Church and how they had initially made a statement that was somewhat more pro-gay than they had previously made, but then they started walking it back. Yeah, they've totally walked it back. Language supportive of the LGBT community has now been removed from a Vatican document formerly known as the Relatio of the Extraordinary Synod on the Family. This is according to a statement released last weekend by the Catholic Church leaders. Objections from conservative clergy members led to the removal of the phrase, quote, welcoming homosexual persons, as well as language about homosexuals having gifts and qualities to offer the Christian community. All of that language has now been removed. All of that language, it's gone. So it was a shining moment. So again, I gave him a shout out last week. I'm totally giving him another one right now. Kudos to Andy Hum, one of the co-hosts of Gay USA, because he called it and said, yeah, just don't hold your breath. This is going to go away in about 2 seconds. And indeed, it went away in about 2 seconds. So there you go. I want to take a second and recognize the passing of someone you may not have ever heard of, but was such a big deal in the LGBT community. Gloria Cesarez, who became Philadelphia's first director of the city's Office of LGBT Affairs when Mayor Michael Nutter appointed her to a newly created post in 2008. She passed away last weekend after a long battle with cancer. She was 42 years old. In her role as the head of the mayor's Office of Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Affairs, she helped establish the mayor's advisory board on LGBT affairs. Mayor Nutter said in a statement, quote, Gloria was a fun, serious, strong, and kind person who always wanted to do more for others and who fought for the equality of rights for all people. She was a clear, strong voice to the LGBTQ community in Philadelphia and across America. She served as the executive director of the Gay and Lesbian Latino AIDS Education Initiative in Philadelphia for nearly a decade. So, you know, our thoughts are with her family, with all of Philadelphia, because she really, the work that she did in Philadelphia that was recognized nationally was just incredible. So our thoughts are with her family. And finally, from the serious to the kind of ridiculous, but oh my gosh, this is a story. Some Elvis-themed wedding chapels in Las Vegas are all shook up. I did not write that little pun. That would be the Huffington Post's Gay Voices section. They are all shook up about the new ruling on marriage equality in Nevada, and at least one of them is refusing to host ceremonies for gay couples. A federal appeals court, as we've covered on October 7th, declared same-sex marriage legal in Nevada and Idaho, stating that gay couples' equal protection rights were being violated under the state's unconstitutional same-sex marriage bans. So that opened up same-sex ceremonies in the so-called marriage capital of the world. Well, one location called a Elvis Chapel, that's what it's called, they have said that they will not marry same-sex couples. They said they refuse. They will not open the door, saying there is, quote, no story here. However, an unnamed employee with a Elvis Chapel, shouldn't it be an Elvis Chapel? Why is it a Elvis Chapel? Anyway, This unnamed employee said, quote, "We want to follow the law. We don't, however, for biblical reasons, believe in that. It has nothing to do with our feelings toward any people. We don't want to discriminate against people at all, but our ministries are unable to do that, and at this time we do not believe in that. We hope not to refuse anyone any service, and we certainly do not want to be in violation of the law. However, we do not fully know what we will do next, and we are in touch with legal counsel." So again, Elvis is marrying you, but he won't marry you if you're two people of the same sex. So the solemnity offered by A. Elvis Chapel, not necessarily the grammar offered by A. Elvis Chapel, only goes so far. And on that note, I mean, if you're going to end with an Elvis Chapel, that's the way you end. And that's the way we're ending this week's episode. Our huge, huge thanks to Casper Andreas. What a treat to have him back after 5 years. Holy cow. We've been doing this for a while, and we haven't had him on for a while. So, again, go on over to kissmekillmemovie.com. And please, if you can, support the funding of more LGBT stories in our movies that are out there in the world. It only greases the wheels for more content to be made. That's the great thing about crowdsource funding. It inspires more people to create more content, and you can be a part of it. So stroll on over, kissmekillmemovie.com. You guys, get out there. Go use your voices to make a difference in this world for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And of course, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?